Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today on ID the Future, we have a real treat for our listeners. We have with us Dr. Richard Sternberg, an evolutionary biologist with interests in the relation between genes, morphological homologies, and the nature of genomic information. Dr. Sternberg holds two PhDs, one in biology, molecular evolution, from Florida International University, and another in systems science from Binghamton University. He has previously served as a staff scientist at the National Center for Biotechnology Information, as well as the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Dr. Sternberg is presently a research scientist at the Biologic Institute, and we're here to talk today with him about the origin of whales. So, Dr. Sternberg, thank you so much for coming on the show with us.
My pleasure.
So, the occasion for bringing you on the show right now is a new ID documentary that was released by Illustra Media recently titled Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. And, of course, Dr. Sternberg, you are featured in this documentary talking about the origin of whales and whether or not they show evidence for Darwinian evolution or for intelligent design. And I'll first say that I want our listeners to definitely go and check out this new documentary from Illustra Media. And even though I think we're going to have a really great conversation with Dr. Sternberg today about the origin of whales, you've got to see the animations they have in the video. I don't know how else to say this. In the documentary, they have some fabulous animated sequences showing many of the complex features that we see in whales that pose a challenge to Darwinian evolution. So if you want to supplement what you're hearing Dr. Sternberg talk about today, you definitely want to go and pick up a copy of the new documentary, Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth, to actually get a visual understanding of what we're talking about here. So, okay, Dr. Sternberg, you did a great job, first of all, in Living Waters talking about the evolution of whales. So thank you for your great work on this topic.
Well, thank you.
So I'd really like for you to start us off today talking about some of these supposed transitional fossils that we often hear about when people talk about the origin of whales. This has sort of become almost an icon of evolution, the idea that there are these transitional forms showing how land mammals evolved into whales. You talk about some of these supposed transitions in the cetacean series in the documentary Living Waters, but could you sort of give us an idea of what are some of these supposed transitional fossils and how much time is allowed by the fossil record for this supposed evolutionary transition from land mammals to whales?
Certainly. By 2001, it became a popular notion that the evolutionary sequence or transitions from the so-called walking whales, of which the earliest is Pachycetus, to the modern whales, of course, those are the baleen whales and the toothed whales, was considered the poster child for macroevolution because it was considered 14 years ago to be the best example of a nice graded series of mammals, exemplifying the transition from a terrestrial mode of living to a fully aquatic mode of living. And that, of course, piqued my interest. The time span that transpired from Pachycetus to the first modern cetacean, the so-called new whales or the neocetes, is only 14 million years. And that is an extremely short period of geological time. Now, to put that into context, the estimated period of time that elapsed between the divergence of chimpanzees and ourselves from a last common ancestor is 5.5 million years or so. And the morphological distinctions between chimpanzees and humans are, in my opinion, quite slight compared to the morphological distinctions between a Pachycetus and a dolphin, one of the earliest dolphins. But we can shed more light on that. If you look at the transition from Pachycetus, that looked like a four-legged, dog-like mammal, to the first fully aquatic cetacean, a member of the Bathysaurus, and that would be either Bathysaurus or Diordon, is estimated to be anywhere from 8 to 9 million years. And so right after the appearance of Bathysaurus, Diordon, and other members of the Bathysaurus, then you have the emergence, roughly 5 million years later, of the modern cetaceans. So altogether, roughly 14 million years. Now, if you look at a magazine illustration of the kind you would find in National Geographic, or if you take a textbook illustration, you will see artistic renditions of a nice graded series where you start out with, again, a four-legged dog-esque mammal, Pachycetus, and its kin. Then you pass through, or you'll see in a phylogeny, an evolutionary tree, you'll see these intermediate forms that have reduced hind limbs. They are becoming more elongated, whale-like, and with tail flukes beginning to appear. So you see a morphing from Pachycetus to a Basilosaurus or a Dordon. And this was long thought to be the case because the putative intermediates were based largely on anatomical reconstructions of the head. So the post-cranial part of the body, those fossils, were not known until relatively recently. What we have learned since that time is that many of the intermediates have been depicted, and here I'm thinking of Eocetus, Georgiocetus, and others of the so-called protocetids that appear in the fossil record just before you see the basilosaurids, the first fully aquatic cetaceans that we know of. We now know that Georgiocetus and some of the other protocetids did not have tail flukes. They did not have the modified vertebral column for attaching the musculature required to have tail flukes to that column. They had well-developed hind limbs. We have fossils where the fetus is not in the breech position, as you see with modern cetaceans. Rather, the fetus is oriented in the same way that you see with terrestrial mammals. That is, with the head facing outward, the head of the fetus. It turns out that the transition from Pachycetus to the Basilosaurids and then on to the modern cetaceans was not only extremely rapid, but it fits the pattern of punctuated equilibrium, which one individual, Stephen Jay Gould, made popular, where what you see in the fossil record, instead of a gradualistic series of transitions, you see these punctuations where you have variations on the theme and then dramatic changes in morphological structure with the appearance of new body plans. And that's exactly what you see with the cetacean sequence. It is staggered. Most of the complexity appearing at the point in time when the basilosaurids emerged or shortly thereafter. In fact, the basilosaurids plus the modern whales belong to a lineage that has been termed the Pelagiceti because they're pelagic. What that refers to is the fact that almost all the innovations that characterize modern cetaceans appear with the basilosaurids. You do not find them in any of the earlier fossil whales.
So Dr. Sternberg, just to reiterate, what exactly are the time frames we're working with here to go from a full-fledged land mammal like Pachycetus to a fully aquatic whale-like mammal? How much time are we talking about is allowed for that transition in the fossil record?
8 to 9 million years.
The next question then is, what exactly has to happen in that 8 to 9 million years? You don't get many of the traits that are necessary for a full-fledged aquatic whale, like the tail flukes, like the specialized vertebral column, until you get something that is kind of like a modern whale, and that's obviously something like the Basilosaurids or Duradon. Not quite exactly like current whales, but at least they're fully aquatic and they've got all the main features.
Correct.
So what exactly are some of those features that need to arise in this transition as you're going from a full-fledged land mammal to a fully aquatic whale?
If you examine the morphology of Dordon, and there is an excellent monograph on the morphology, and you compare that to what is known Pachycetus and Ambulocetus and some of the other early walking whales, but what you find is that virtually every single aspect of the neuromuscular system, of the skeletal system, of the internal organ systems, reproductive strategies, etc., have been modified heavily. And incidentally, if it were the case that Basilosaurus and Dordon, there was an individual still swimming, you would think it was some kind of modern whale. They're not that different, relatively speaking. For example, there are modifications of the eye for being able to hunt prey underwater. You have the modifications of breathing. As you move along, what you find is that there's a telescoping of the cranium. You have the movement of the nasal openings to a more posterior position along the cranium. If you look at a dolphin, for example, it looks as if the blowhole is sitting right on top of its head, and in a sense it is. But you've had a extensive reorganization of, say, the frontal bones and the jaw bones. The cranium has been reorganized. You have a reorganization of the dentition, that is, the organization of the teeth. You have a separation of the esophagus from the trachea, at least in the case of modern whales, and you can presumably map that back to bathysaurids. You have the development of a mandibular fat pad. Cetaceans, at least back then and now, did not and do not hear the way that terrestrial mammals hear. They have a fat pad that was well developed by the time you get to the bathysaurids. It's a fat pad that receives sounds from underwater and then transmit those sounds to the ear bones. And those mandibular fat pads, incidentally, are composed of a number of distinct fatty acids that have interesting acoustical properties. By the time that the bathysaurids appear, you have not only the separation of the hind limbs from the sacral region, what you also have is they are rudimentary. They are within the abdominal cavity, and they are interpreted not as quote-unquote vestigial organs, but as supports for the reproductive structures. You would have the development of an axial musculature for swimming and for hunting prey at rather fast speeds. The vertebral column, by the time you have bathysaurids, and this you do not see with the protocetids, was by that time more uniform. You have the development of what is called a ball vertebra. Think of it as like a tennis ball. It's not perfectly round, of course, but it allows the tail to move vertically. You have the development of tail flukes and the musculature and the skeletal supports for the musculature. And, of course, the bathysaurids and modern whales, they could not and they cannot, respectively, support themselves on land. This means that with bathysaurids, they gave birth in an aquatic environment. They reproduced fully there. That means the labor giving birth to the calf had to occur underwater. Nursing the calf had to have occurred underwater. It's a very broad suite of traits that emerged quite rapidly as soon as you had the first member of the Pelagicetae, these fully aquatic cetaceans. And that occurred again in less than 8 to 9 million years.
So, Dr. Sternberg, if I can just summarize here, because I have a condensed list of some of these modifications that need to occur to go from a land mammal to a whale, and maybe I'll just summarize these really quick, and you tell me if I missed anything, although I'm sure that there's a lot more than what's on anyone's list that they can come up with. So, to go from a land mammal to a whale, you need to evolve, essentially, a countercurrent heat exchanger for the intra-abdominal testes. You need to evolve ball vertebrae. You need to evolve tail flukes and musculature. You need blubber for temperature insulation. You need a reorganization of the kidney tissues. You need to evolve the ability to have the fetus in breech position for labor underwater. You need the ability to nurse your young underwater, which requires modified mammae. You need four limbs that are transformed into flippers. You need the reduction of the hind limbs. You need the reduction or loss of the pelvis and sacral vertebrae. You need the reorganization of the musculature for the reproductive organs. You need hydrodynamic properties of the skin. You need special lung surfactants. You need novel muscle systems for the blowhole. You need modification of the teeth, modification of the eye for underwater vision. And then you need the emergence and expansion of the mandibular fat pad with complex lipid distribution. Did I miss anything there?
Oh, well, yes, you missed a lot. I certainly have missed a lot. If you look at, if you study cetacean anatomy, embryology, what you'll find is that it doesn't really matter the part of the body that you want to focus on. It has been extensively modified. For example, the countercurrent heat exchange system, it's a fascinating example. Cetacea are one set of a group of mammals that have intra-abdominal testes. The testes do not descend. This creates a problem for sperm production because if you have testes that are at core body temperature, then you do not get production of the gametes, male gametes. So what you see with the modern cetacea, and by extrapolation, this could be mapped back to the bathysaurids, so I think, is you have a plexus of arteries and veins that envelop the testes. what this plexus does effectively is it shunts cooled blood from the extremities to the region surrounding the male gonads, and it shunts the warmed blood away and out to the extremities. Even though a cetacean could be swimming at a rather fast pace, think of a dolphin swimming alongside a vessel, generating a lot of heat from the action of the musculature, nevertheless, the testes remain at a temperature that is below the core body temperature, and thus they have viable sperm. So it's a remarkable innovation. That's one example. When you look at the mandibular fat pad, you look at the arrangement in three dimensions of fatty acids, and this, by the way, develops during embryogenesis, fetogenesis. But what you have is the localization of specific fatty acids that are rather optimal for picking up and transmitting sounds. One of those fatty acids is isovaleric acid. Now, why is isovaleric acid of interest? Well, it is toxic to mammals. A small dose of that fatty acid will induce a coma and perhaps death in a rat. It will do the same in humans. Nevertheless, in the case of cetaceans, they are either obtaining isovaleric acid and metabolizing it and localizing it, obviously in a way that does not entail lethality, or they're producing it de novo by some novel metabolic pathway. And those are just two examples. You could go on with a number of other examples. But yes, when you look at the parts list of a cetacean, a member of the Pelagicidae, then you end up with just a staggering number of innovations.
One of those that you just talked about, Dr. Sternberg, talking about the cooling system, that really is a wonderful part of the new documentary, Living Waters, Intelligent Design and the Oceans of the Earth. I would exhort our ID the Future listeners to check that out to get a wonderful visual animation sequence explaining exactly what we're talking about. But for now, Dr. Sternberg, I just have one question. When you talk about the plexus in the whale, you're not talking about the pink weight loss drink, right?
No, not at all.
Okay, great. I'm glad to hear that.
I'm not plugging any product yet, no.
Okay, good. So I want our ID Future listeners to stay tuned for more with Dr. Rick Sternberg on the topic of the origin and the evolution of whales and whether or not they evolved by Darwinian evolution or whether they're a better case for intelligent design. We're going to have a second podcast on this topic with Dr. Sternberg. We're going to go into more detail about the problem that the evolution and the origin of whales poses for Darwinism. We've sort of set the stage here. We've teed the ball. We're going to come back. Dr. Sternberg, will you come back with us and talk about this some more?
Yes, I'll be happy to.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Richard Sternberg.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.